I'm sure some of you will recognize this line. We are we are dreamers, makers, dreamers, shapers, singers, makers. And that's a great way of thinking of what hacking is. Danae Valentina will be talking about the similarities between the hacker and the shaman.
Hey, hello all. I can't see anything from here. Thank you for coming to my talk, The Hacker and the Shaman, Travelers of the Black Box. During the next minutes, I will be presenting a comparative analysis between these two figures. I will talk about their similarities and how their exploratory practices can be related to the concept of black box. First, I would like to introduce myself very briefly so you know where I'm coming from. I consider myself mostly a writer. I identify myself as a transcultural feminist writer. I was born in Chile in 2012, I moved to the UK to study grad school at the University of Bristol. Now I live in the city of Rotterdam, where I am a postgraduate research student on literary studies. The topics of my research are posthumanist literature, altered states of mind, and the cyberspace. But to study all this stuff, I need money, since my family is poor and they cannot afford this kind of education. And that's why I've been working since I was very young, first as a web developer in Santiago, and then as a project manager, fundraiser, and researcher in advocacy organizations dedicated to the internet and human rights. For example, Derechos Digitales in Chile, Coding Rights in Brazil, and soon in the Mozilla Foundation. I'm also a member of the Rise Up Collective, where we are dedicated to build secure communication tools for social justice. This is my second time at HOPE, first time as a speaker. And all this, it hasn't been easy, but I think I know a thing or two about the internet, and I believe that I'm progressively more interested in its artistic, literary possibilities, and how the internet can become a source for post-humanist thinking rather than this boring, completely surveilled space that is today. You can check my poorly updated blog. And if you want to contact me, you can go to that address. It's danae.noblogs.org. Now let me tell you about how this research originated. This started as a masterclass project at the Utrecht University in the Netherlands. The topic of this seminar was the black box. In a small group of four researchers, each of us explored one aspect of this topic, the black box, and it also involved a plan for an artistic exhibition. I'm telling you this so you know that this is an academic effort with a visual art component, but for this talk, I'll try to adapt my language and perspective to this tech audience. And also, please bear in mind that I'm not a technologist, and that's why I'd like to invite you to look at this thing with a more literary, artistic lens. So let's start. What's a black box? We can start clarifying what is a black box. This diagram is vastly used to explain that. We have an input that goes to the black box, and then in the black box, something happens, and we get an output. If I send a text message to a friend, I don't really know what happens in the middle, but he or she receives the message in her cell phone, also without knowing exactly what happened in the middle. This middle, the cell phone, is the black box. But many researchers, for example, Peter Sloterdijk, used the concept of black box not just for complex machines. They also think that the human soul, the human body, could be considered a black box too. For instance, last week I watched this fantastic film by Andrei Tarkovsky. The film name is Andrei Rublev. And it was so good, and I still can't stop thinking about it. All the emotions that the film provoked in me and the experience I had. I was in Berlin in this big cinema with this huge screen, and I really think it changed me as a person. In this case, the film is the input. My mind is the black box, and the output is this, the new me, and all the stuff on image and emotion that I keep talking to my friends. And here we have two quotes I selected from some scholars who have been studying the topic of the black box. Both refer to the black box using the example of the complex machine. The first one is a quote by Bruno Latour about black boxing. The way scientific and technical work is made invisible by its own success. When a machine runs efficiently, when a matter of fact is settled, one needs to focus only on its inputs and outputs and not on its internal complexity. Thus, paradoxically, the more science and technology succeed, the more opaque and obscure they become. And the second one is a quote by Peter Sloterdijk, which is very complementary to the Latour one. And he speaks about users who are happy with being just users. Be smart, be an idiot. This is the motto of the new black box ethic. At some point in history, we stopped understanding how technology works. For example, I think my mother can explain to me the way photography or analog cinema work, because it's relatively easy to understand what does light into a photosensitive paper and how then you see it in a big projector. But she probably cannot explain and explain the operations of a digital camera, for example. Also, she and me, I know how to use a digital camera. So here we are with these two black boxes, the human consciousness and the complex machine. Some men, maybe in this very conference, could say, but I know exactly how a computer works, that's not a black box for me. Yeah, some psychologists could say the same about the human consciousness, that they know every detail about it. And well, I prefer to have an approach in which we admit that we do not know everything, that our life is full of black boxes, full of obscurities, and that it is through a hacking approach how we travel, never fully decipher these obscurities. To me, hacking has to do with playing within these black boxes and eventually alter the expected outcomes, like in the diagram we saw some slides ago. Hacking is a knowledge production system and could be applied to any kind of black box. Probably there are some people who think that someone who studied computer science and know how digital devices work is a hacker. It's all right for them, but for this particular project of mine, I will consider hacking everything that, with a sense of play, alters the obscurities of our environment. And this is why the concept of black box is useful. Let's look at this quote, magic, the mother of technology. This is a quote by Peter Sloterdijk again. And in the last slide, I tried to explain why hacking to me is to alter the black boxes in order to obtain unexpected outputs. When this happens, the final result looks like magic, isn't it? And here's where I connect the figure of the shaman with the figure of the hacker. In shamanic sessions, weird stuff happens. When the human being is in an altered state of mind, the things you see do not look rational. And it's the same with hacking. If a website is hacked, the visitors, even the administrators, will not understand easily what happened there at the first look. And I'm not afraid of using the concept of magic because it allows us to be imaginative on what we can do through a hacker shamanic approach. So let's go to the core of this comparative analysis. These two are the books that I used to do this study. Both belong to the discipline of anthropology. To investigate shamans, I used Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy by Mircea Eliade. He's a Romanian scholar, and this is considered the largest and most validated study on shamans. And for the case of hackers, I used the excellent book Coding Freedom by Gabriela Coleman. And now I'm going to present the most relevant comparative points between these two figures and their practices. We can start the relation of these two realms with esotericism. This meaning everything related to mystery and to what is not inscribed in rationalist thinking. By definition, shamanism is an esoteric practice. It involves a process that cannot be rationally explained. It involves a relation with dead ancestors and spirits that guide the shaman. I find very beautiful this Eliade quote about an assistant spirit. I mount it and she takes me to show me different countries. It's cool, it's kind of sensual too. And on the other side, hacker culture is full of esoteric references. Coleman mentions references in their software releases and interests on issues as conspiracy theory, hard-hitting political news, playful nonsense, voyeurism, ritualistic software exchange. I know there's this Linux distribution, Sorcerer. It's full of esotericism here. Also, I saw this tweet the other day that the people from this very conference wrote the other day referring to the zodiac of hacking, which is this one, that includes several dimensions of the hacker culture as the hardware hacking, the social engineer, the hacktivist. And I find it very cool in astrology hacking. Why not? Congrats to them. This is another point. Maybe controversial, and it's about humility. Because to me, shamanic and hacking practice require a significant level of humility. This is really important to me to differentiate hackers from egocentric tech guys who think they know everything and do stuff like telling the others how to do their work, especially if this self-appointed hacker is a man and is mansplaining a woman that has worked many years on what she does. Maybe I'm talking about a personal situation. And, well, Eliade says that a shaman is a man who has immediate concrete experiences with gods and spirits. He sees them face to face. He talks with them, prays to them, implores them. But he does not control more than a limited number of them. Coleman, on her side, says that the hacker soon discovered he could never really master all of this, and that he actually exists in an asymptotic relationship to technology. I read that as someone who develops herself and in an interdependent relation that tends to infinity, since knowledge never ends, has no limits. And it's crazy the amount of people who cannot assume this issue of humility. That's why we finish with male figures that are located in this genius rockstar category that never admit their ignorance in a vast number of subjects. And this is an aspect that I really like, camouflage. And I think it's connected to the previous one too, the aspect of humility. Describing shamanic rituals, Eliade explains that in order to facilitate a smooth contact with nature, The shaman embodies an animal during the seance using costumes and masks. I'm sure you have seen this kind of looks in registers of shamanic rituals, like a guy dressed like a bird. Those costumes are clearly related with the inherent anonymity of hacking, where real names are never revealed. And we even have a case of a group who actually uses masks as anonymous, a group that Gabriela Goldman has studied vastly. To me, this has to do with an ethic that rejects authorship and property and differentiates the approaches to the black box. This item maybe is sad, is frustration. I guess that real shamanism and hacking has not much to do with what we consider success and recognition in our capitalist society nowadays. And this is why frustration is at the center of both practices. But pay attention, because it's a frustration that necessarily operates as the counterpart of pleasure. Eliade explains that to enter into contact with the spirits or to obtain guardian spirits, the aspirant withdraws into solitude and subjects himself to a strict regime of self-torture. And Coleman claims that the affective stances of hackers, most notably their deep engagement, sometimes is born of frustration and another times is born of pleasure. And sometimes these two converge. And this is the reward, the ecstasy. To Eliade, what differentiates a shaman from any other individual in the clan is not his possessing a power or a guardian spirit, but his ecstatic experience. And Gabriela Coleman also uses language related to ecstasy. She explains that because hackers often submit their will and being to technology, and are famous for denying their bodies sleep, at least for short periods, the joy that hackers derive from attending to and carefully sculpting technologies are at times experienced as transcendent bliss. That's pretty amazing, and to me is extremely related to the reach, the quest for an altered state of mind. And which is the ultimate altered state of mind? Death. And specifically, returning from the dead. For Eliade and for Coleman, shamans and hackers attempt to reach a state close to death in order to obtain all the forces that come with the resurrection. Eliade explains the following. The shaman must die so he can meet the souls of the dead. Death is suggested by means as extreme fatigue, tortures, fasting, and so on. Once you see the death, you're not frightened anymore. And Coleman, in her book, has a fantastic description of a Linux installation. I'm going to read it to you. Installing Linux, larva stage of hacking. Period of monomaniacal concentration on coding apparently passed through by all fledgling hackers. Common symptoms include the perpetuation of more than 136-hour hacking run in a given week, neglect of all other activities, including usual basics like food, sleep, and personal hygiene. And a chronic case of advanced bleary eye can last from 6 months to 2 years, the apparent median being around 18 months. A few so afflicted never resume a more normal life, but the ordeal seems to be necessary to produce really wizardly as opposed to merely competent programmers. And yes, you die, but you resurrect stronger than the rest of the mortals. And this is the final comparison I selected for this presentation. It's the one of the ritual. I chose these two pictures. The first one is of a hacking conference, and the second is a shamanic ritual. And to me, they are very similar. There's the darkness, the lightning in the participant faces, this blue hue product of the laptop screens in the first case, the reflection of the fire in the second image. There's cables, a sense of crowd, of reunion in both images. And for both scholars, the ritual is a central part of the shamanic and hacking practice. Eliade says that in the course of his initiation, the future shaman has to learn the secret language that he will use during his seance to communicate with the spirits and animal spirits. And Coleman complements, explaining that beyond programming languages, hacker conferences are rituals of confirmation, liberation, celebration, and especially re-enchantment, where the quotidian affair of life, work, labor, and social interactions are ritualized and thus experienced on fundamentally different terms. And I like how both quotes are complementary, since they show how shamans and hackers need to learn new languages, but these languages have to be used, confirmed, liberated in a ritual. And, well, I'm almost finishing this presentation, and I would like to show you this video I edited. It's 6 minutes. Maybe you find it long, but it's important to me for you to reflect on this weird thesis that I'm proposing to you. It's an overlapping of a shamanic ritual in a hacker conference. I don't want to tell you what to think anymore. I just want you to look at these images, hear the sounds, also look around you and see if this way of thinking makes sense to you. If magic, the idea of magic, inspires you to hack everything around you. This is the video. Maybe we can turn off the lights a little. Psychedelics or something like that. Thank you. Well, it's kind of similar, I think, the ta-da-da-da-da with people in their keywords. I think that repetition somehow leads you to some weird altered state of mind. I don't know. I want to finish this presentation with a quote of Nanni Balestrini about coding that is in the catalog of Jean-François Lyotard exhibition, Les Immatériaux. I decided not to translate it for the slide because I love how it looks in French. Tu coffres de simulation entre désir et réseau, tu d'aspire de nature entre flow et lumière. This means, in my poorly English translation, every body of simulation between desire and network, every spy of nature between blur and light. In Spanish, for my friends who are watching me in Chile and in Mexico, is todo cuerpo de simulación entre deseo y red, todo espía de la naturaleza entre desenfoque y luz. And to me, the conclusion that I have from all this is that to hack is to travel through obscurity, to melt with the light, to embrace blurriness, and to do magic. And that was my presentation. I'm happy to have your questions now.
That was lovely, by the way.
Thank you.
So asking as a data scientist, whose field is often referred to as modern alchemy, do you see the intersections of shamanism and technology as empowering to the field or something to be wary of?
Yeah, I think it's empowering, especially for, for communities that are not in the north or communities with different paradigms of how you think about stuff. That's why I like the quote about magic, how magic is the mother of technology, how things that in the first instance looked very weird and impossible then became possible. It's not that I'm one of these people who is against vaccination or who believes that the Earth is flat, but still I don't see how good is this idea of being skeptical to everything. I think that's probably the contribution to the field, like incorporating other ways of thinking. I'm thinking about indigenous cultures and the global south.
Hello, I've been looking forward to this all week because my friend gave me this ticket to see this conference, and out of all the ones that I saw in the schedule, this one was the most intriguing to me because I've been studying the mind, and what became very fascinating to me is there's a gland in the brain called the pineal gland, and it contains crystals known as DMT, and those crystals are what is known as piezoelectric, which means if you apply pressure to them, they create an electrical charge. And I find that very similar to the way our computers work. So what I'm asking you is there really a difference between finding transcendence in spirituality and like the spirit world? Are they comparable in the sense that by looking and utilizing technology as a tool to communicate with the spirit world, are you finding an alternative method, or are we talking the same thing?
I'm certainly cannot answer if we are going to how can we find transcendence. I'm not a specialist in spirituality, but I think it worth the shot. I think it's a resource. A computer is a resource. It's a tool. You can do whatever you want with that. You can maybe similar what you do with some drugs too, like using the stuff as a method to know about new ways of thinking about the things that surround us, but yeah.
As far as magic is concerned, I found this also very interesting. As far as frequency is concerned, when you look at a screen, it's going at a certain hertz, like most screens in North America are 60, or in Europe it's 50. What's so interesting about that is if that technology was used to alter those frequencies, could we use technology to get into more receptive states where we can communicate with the, you know?
Maybe. Let's try that. I don't know how I'm up to that.
Thank you.
So I know the shaman role has always been like this mystic leader and wise guy that kind of has the everything, the answer for everything. And the hacker on the other side has also been revered, so to speak, by social media, particularly lately with all, you know, the whistleblowers, all the surveillance stuff that's going on and everything. So I'm kind of curious about your thoughts over the similarities between the social aspects, or rather the social roles of both these figures.
Yeah, I thought about that, and I think there's maybe a gender issue about it. When I first started this thing, I thought that one similarity is that shamans and hackers are mostly males, but it's not really true. There's many, there's in ancient tribes, there are women who have this shamanic role. And I know that there are women that are exploring and using technology in different ways that are not really like the thing that maybe you are referencing to, like this public persona, like who has to have an opinion on everything. To me, that there are social aspects for both figures, but they are intersected by several other components. I think one is gender. I don't know if that's an answer.
Hi, thank you very much for this talk. And something I really connected with what you were talking about in terms of the ritual aspect of working with, you know, as a hacker and on Linux and certain things with, in relation specifically to learning, that seems to be the key is going through a process, even though you might have instructions on how to do something, you know, you have to go through it yourself and you apply your own processes to what you find, and you might think of questions other people might not have come up with and find a different perspective on things, and certainly that's part of the other part of the point of coming up with your own perspective and then sharing that. And the fact that ritual practice in terms of Buddhism for the idea of attaining nirvana, that the point seemed to be that it has to be experienced. You can explain it up to a certain point, but it has to be experienced. And I would see this, you know, I experience it individually learning Linux, but also sitting down to a table learning how to solder. You know, basically going back to ground to a beginning state, and you know, where other people that are on that same level and there specifically to go on this journey of learning how to do this thing, and you know, seeing what they find along the way together with other people going through that. And that was the most visceral way that I had experienced that, and that you know, that I love that makerspaces and all these things aimed at learning, teaching kids how to code, and you know, as a parent-child process for techie parents, and that's a really cool thing that's been happening. And just wanted to, you know, see if there's anything similar to that you've experienced on your own with learning about technology, or if it's mostly just the abstract.
Yeah, it's good that you bring the topic of the ritual. I believe that. It's boring. It makes no sense if you do this thing alone. It has to, and not just because it's boring. It's like incomplete in terms of knowledge and experience. You need that kind of synthesis. That has been my experience actually doing research, living my life, and doing the work with the amazing people I've had the chance to work with, like in a collective way. In an egalitarian way, but having this interaction, yeah?
Yeah.
Totally.
Even if it's after the fact, like an initial individual journey, but then you discuss what you found and exchange of ideas from there, and that's encouraged the RTFM thing to start out with, you know, but then people talk about what they found and certainly for troubleshooting and all of that.
Yeah, it starts individually, like this quest. The idea of quest is in both figures too, like in the shaman and in the hacker. But yeah, it's like the ecstasy, the climatic experience, it appears in the ritual, the collective space.
Hi. I was really thrilled to see all the parallels that you drew, so thank you for putting all this together. And I really liked that you said right up front that you're not afraid to use the word magic, and that kind of piqued my interest as you're approaching this as a researcher, as an academic. Do you see any contradictions in trying to rationalize this stuff? I've always felt like being skeptical sometimes limits the possibilities. So like having magic in our vocabulary, I want more of that for people to accept that maybe something strange is happening here and to keep going even when things are strange. So I'm kind of just curious as your experience in academia trying to kind of write this down for a very sort of rationalist, skeptical audience. How does that work out for you?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And academia is terrible in that sense. In academia, you have to do your research and adapt it to strict frameworks of what they want to read because they need to get research grants. I like this concept of unlearning that in more advanced schools people is using. To me, it could be kind of related with magic. I mean, with this idea of with these ideas that we do not comprehend completely. I think it's a way cooler approach than the other, than colonizing the unknown and put it in boxes that fit everything that we already know. I see magic in that sense.
So I'm going to go on the opposite side of that question, because I would say, like, my sense is that you're being modest with your presentation. And maybe that's a projection, but I'm curious, you know, I don't know what your experiences with shamanic experiences or, but I'm curious, like, where you've gone in terms of thought experiments with, you know, post-humanism or, you know, post-evolution or whatever with, you know, I get the sense when you're talking about magic, like, I'm just curious what, like, you know, rather than, like, trying to, like, follow skeptics, like, I'm over here, I want to, like, just say, see, where have you gone in terms of, like, thoughts about, like, what excites you? Like, what's the, like, if there is an end game or a, like, where have you gone? What do you think would happen to humanity? You know, are we tapping into something that, as engineers, are like, that will eventually make sense, you know, in terms of the magic?
I think I'm a pretty normal person. I haven't had, like, in this really super altered, ecstatic experiences. Maybe I have some psychedelic drugs once or twice or three, four times, but I think it's better to use the concept of posthumanism. It's something that is has been used in academy, at least in the Utrecht University, the place where I'm doing my research. And it's this idea of decentering the human from the research that is being done, like moving away from this rationalist way of thinking and This is related to disciplines or areas like animal studies, environmental studies, all the idea of the Anthropocene, and more than what you, the individual, can do and how can you travel into this new weird experiences, which is fine, is also to think about other forms of agency that are not human. Those are the experiences that we can use. Mm-hmm. Posthumanism, cool stuff to learn about.
All right. Hi, so I just want to say thank you for the wonderful talk. I think it's very important for this community. I just have kind of one question. What do you think about, sort of in this framework of yours, about the relationship and role of power? And so, you know, one thing you're talking about is this whole parallel with shamanism and the hacker, you know, ritual of knowledge production through self-sacrifice, and that's great, and, you know, so everyone participates in that. But if we take technology as a black box and we remove the element of sacrifice from the equation, and, you know, now we say, you know, someone mentioned, like, data science as a modern alchemy, and that's okay, we embrace it as a magic, but then, you know, you really move that to an entity that's a corporation that is sort of controlling that. What does, you know, what does that mean? And sort of, you know, how the relationship of power gets abused in this context.
Yeah, I guess that at some point with the questions, we started to talk about magic and drugs and stuff. And the whole point of the thing was to think about a hacker approach to the black boxes. I mean, that's a huge problem. The things that we are living now with this data science thing, with datafication of everything, with the surveillance that we experience today. And what we have to do is to travel through that with a hacking ethic, and to this is what I think, and alter the potential outputs. I mean, of course, it's cool to think about, like, all the mystical aspects of this, but still we can be an active agent and do stuff about it outside the normal things that you are expected to do, like legislation or whatever, which is fine too, but maybe we can think of a more hacker approach to all these problems.
I'd also like to thank you for this talk. It's very timely, it's very appropriate, and very welcome. One thing that I noticed you didn't touch on was the community aspect, which this conference is all about community. Hackers in general, the hacker conferences tend to be about community, and the role of the shaman is supposed to be like a sort of a diplomat between the other world and this one with regard to serving and protecting community. And that's a very, very key point. You know, there's a lot of people who get into shamanism because it's like cool, you know, oh, I can wave a candle and do magic things. But you can die in that black box. You can die for real, not just die and then come back. Sometimes you don't come back, you know, and the same thing can happen from a hacker perspective. You can do RM minus RF splat, you know, I mean, it's a newbie mistake, but people make it. My question is, would you, in a future talk, address the warrior function? Because the warrior function of the shaman is one of the main functions, to protect the community, to serve the community. Now, who do you protect the community from? Your spirit guides tell you this. You've passed tests. That's what the torture is for. It's a test. If you pass the test, then you are given power, but with that power, of course, with any power comes responsibility. Who are you protecting it from? Well, the opposite of the shaman is the sorcerer. A sorcerer is somebody who aggregates power for their own purposes. They exploit communities. They do not serve them. So from the perspective of how does this work for hackers, you see people working against all the surveillance, all the, you know, exploitation of our technology, with intent to empower corporations or groups that are not necessarily democratically elected or things like that. So I'm hoping in future talks that you will address that, the warrior function of the shaman, the warrior function of the hacker. And who do you protect this community from? You've got to look at that very carefully. because there are people who would very much like to synthesize the shamanic process of selection. They would like you to think that you're talking to spirit animals or guides or whatever, when you're actually talking to some guy who might be in Utah with a microphone.
Yeah, thank you for that point. I think it's super real, super important. It's super true that many people do not return from these ecstatic experiences. And I'm sure that there are in this community, there are people who haven't returned from the practice they do. It's sad, and it's something that we should be worrying about. And regarding the other point you mentioned, like when you kind of become a demon, it's something that has been studied too. It happened with this difference that once that existed once between the hacker and the cracker, like when you use your abilities for traveling in these black boxes for the evil. And what is the evil now? And it's a huge topic, and I think the community is the one who has to think which is the evil. Maybe it's fascism, maybe it's your president, But yeah, thank you for the point of the responsibility. It's really, really important. Elida!
Hello. I don't know if you have interest in doing field work in California, but California is really brilliant at the following three things. We're really good at stealing and appropriating and commodifying other people's culture. And in particular, both hackers and shamans. I mean, most of what passes for hacking in like the Bay Area is just fucking corporate tools. But also, with the intersection of, you know, like Burning Man, and also I grew up in Santa Cruz. If you're familiar with Santa Cruz, it's like it's like if like Walt Disney decided to like commodify Eastern religions and shamanic practice and like package it for white middle class people. Like that's the culture and the industry of Santa Cruz. So anyway, if you ever have any interest in like. There's other parallels of like where this question of power and where it intersects with like other dominant hegemonic forms of economics and cultural appropriation. California is just a really lovely site to explore some of those if you want to come visit me sometime.
Cool. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I guess that it's something that I myself should be wary about too. And that's what I don't like about the academia. Like, let's colonize these cultures and putting them in categories. That's the challenge of the post-humanist aim. Like how you do it, like without interfering the cool stuff that's happening there. And well, in the capitalist society, it's super difficult to do that. But yeah, that's it.